Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about taste with some of my favorite people in the world, people who are constantly thinking about the food we eat and the food culture that we live in. And we were so caught up with today's guest before we started, we almost forgot we had a show to do. It's such a pleasure to welcome Dana Cowan, who's the editor-in-chief of Food & Wine magazine and a source of so much great information about food in this city, even in Bushwick, where we are on a sweaty Wednesday morning, but all over the country and the world. Thank you for being here, Dana.
I'm so happy to be here. It was a great chance to get to Bushwick and walk around a little bit.
Yeah, right. Even though it could be a little cooler, might make for a better walk. There's so much that we can talk about, and maybe we should just start with Food & Wine, which is celebrating its 35th anniversary this year and 25 years of the Best New Chefs, one of the most important and exciting announcements of the year. Who's going to be on that list and who has been on that list? The alumni gatherings that you do, I'm sure, and for the 25th anniversary, the photographs of Aspen where you have your Food & Wine Classic were just incredible. Let's talk a little bit about the 20 years that you've been at the magazine and what you've seen change in chefs and food in America, just on a big scale.
We have seen so much change, and in fact, having the 25th anniversary of the Best New Chefs really gave us a chance to look back at that first class, which had Thomas Keller in it, for example, and the chefs in that first class were doing really exquisite, high-end, often French or French-American tinged food. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when someone went out to dinner, they really went out to dine. It was a big night out. And if you look at the evolution just of the food culture and also of this award, you see that, you know, it's changed so much that the people who are doing the most dazzling, interesting food are not necessarily at the fanciest restaurants where you have to plan so far ahead. You might actually have to wait on a really, really long line, right? In fact,
we're sitting next to one here at Roberta's in Brooklyn, in
exactly.
fact.
Yeah. Carlo was a Food & Wine Best New Chef. Roy Choi, you know, got a Best New Chef award when he had a food truck. Now he has Bricks & Mortar. But it just shows how what we were celebrating is the innovation of cooks in America, and where that innovation can be found has evolved substantially. So you can find it, you know, on a street corner. Mm-hmm. You can find it in a ramen shop. Dave Chang, you know, when he got the award many years ago, literally had one restaurant, and they were making really good ramen. And, you know, he also had other small plates that were dazzling, and his ingredients were great, and he'd rethought, you know, what goes into that broth instead of, you know, that package thing that you knew from college. He reimagined it. But I think that's some of the arc that we've seen. Mm-hmm. Is really in the creativity, the innovation, and all of us being able to experience it in everything from, you know, oysters and pearls, which would be Keller, to, you know, ramen or a taco. Mm.
So I'm curious a little bit about the process, and I'm sure people who read it are, only because one of the things that I find a huge challenge and a consequence of the explosion of interest in food and of great food around the country is, how do you keep up? It's crazy. You know, it used to be one or two restaurants maybe you wanted to try between here and San Francisco, and now there's hundreds, maybe thousands. How does the list come together?
Well, we have stringers all around the country, and we have our own editors who travel endlessly. I mean, every month, Kate Crater, our restaurant editor, is someplace fabulous, different, and new. And people who follow Kate on Twitter will often say to me, you know, did she actually come into work?
Right. You know? That's Kay Crater, if you want to know where she is, right? Kay Crater, I think, is her Twitter handle or something.
Kay Crater, right. Not her entire name.
Right.
And she is in Maine right as we speak. But she is always on the road. And we have a really great network that we've developed over time. Something that interests me is that it used to be that you only found the great food in the big cities. And now you can indeed find it all over the country. And it has become so much harder for us to, be able to reward, write about, introduce all the great chefs all the way across America because there are so many of them. It used to be that they were sort of easy to see because they're, you know, their heads popped up.
Right.
And, you know,
there wasn't anything else in the field.
Exactly. Yeah. But now, I mean, you know, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Austin, Nashville, Memphis. Today in the New York Times, Pete wrote about going to Andy Tyser and Mike Hudman's two restaurants in Memphis. They were best new chefs this year. And, you know, he loved it. Yeah. It was great. But, you know, you got to go to Memphis. You have to travel this country of America and eat in every single city. And you will find so much talent and so much great food. So the challenge now becomes not really identifying the talent, but choosing among them. Because it used to be we'd have fights like, gosh, we have 8 really good ones, but like, who are the last 2? And we'd be a little depressed.
Right.
There were a couple of sad years in there. But now, you know, we have a vociferous fight among those of us who've gone and eaten and said, you know, this person's great and that person's great. And it's really hard to choose.
I can imagine. It's an advent, I think, of the evolution of our cooks and our diners and also social media and all that sort of stuff. And not only in the time that in your tenure and in the magazine's tenure has the food world changed, but the magazine world has changed also. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that. 20 years ago, there was no Twitter. There was no blog, I'm sure, at Food & Wine.
No, it's very interesting because when I got to the magazine, I had a magazine to edit and it seemed really overwhelming. I worked nights. I worked weekends. I sweated over every word. And honestly, I still sweat over every word. However, now, magazine brands also do books. So Food & Wine does, but all the other food magazines do as well. And I oversee tablets, which, again, all of us take what we do in print and then had these beautiful e-reader editions that are so much fun to look through. They glow. You know, the information's organized in a different way.
So they're actually reconfigured. It's not just the magazine online or on digital. Wow.
It's not. The first iteration was a PDF version, which is just what you're saying. It's the exact magazine. But, in fact, it has evolved. And so now, for example, on our tablets, all of the recipes are gathered together in the back and so really easy to use. There's one on each page. So reinventing for the tablet has been so much fun. And then, you know, it used to be that we were tracking the trends and we would have a month, you know, that you'd have to wait for the trends.
Right.
And now if we wait more than a day for some things, we feel like, oh my gosh, there we went. We missed it.
Isn't that amazing? Even this morning, when reading the newspaper, you mentioned Pete Wells. I realize every Wednesday that I've already read most of what comes out. It's an amazing phenomenon.
That's right. You've read it the night before. Right?
Yeah, the night before, or even a few. Sometimes they even release articles for the weekend magazine, you know, on Tuesday and stuff like that. So in a magazine format, I can imagine with a whole month to work with, it's every day is a deadline.
Every day is. And I think one of the things that's quite beautiful about all the expansion of ways to communicate what's new and what's delicious is that each platform has a natural mode of communicating. So in print, we want to be something that you want to hold on to, you want to collect. It really means that 12 times a year, we're creating something that we want you to feel is really special. And, you know, on the website, we want to be sure that we are giving you the quickest, best access to the absolute best, you know, news, recipes, and goings on of the day. Mm. And so it's really fantastic to take this whole world that we love and think, how do people want to deal with it? How do they want to, you know, absorb their news about food and the whole lifestyle? Because Food & Wine and some of the other magazines are really about the life that surrounds food. Mm-hmm. And what's happened in so much of the areas where food has grown, it's a lot of utility. And utility is better served by the web. Hmm. So at Food and Wine, we're trying to give you the whole life to make you just stop, dream, be inspired, pause. And that's not what we're doing in all the other media.
Right. The appeal of food, if you had told me that food was going to be the most aggressive use of social media, I would have, I mean, if I had even known what social media was, I would have probably said, oh, you're crazy because you can't smell it, you can't taste it, whatever. But, I mean, Instagram is just like a giant buffet constantly. I mean, your images, everyone's images, and food has become such a, the social media has become a way for people to participate in what you used to sort of wait and dream about, as you say, when you got the monthly magazine. I think that is such an exciting piece of it that everyone can play.
Right. I think that, you know, food is the new porn, and it's really true. It's, I hate to, I'll stop the metaphor and then say something else, but, you know, it's drippy, it's gooey, it's crunchy, it's, you know, it's very visually enticing. And it's something we do three times a day. Mm-hmm. So, and it's something that can be really exciting three times a day. And I think that, you know, 20 years ago, food wasn't exciting three times a day. I mean, there weren't fantastic places to have breakfast. And, you know, lunch was a sandwich. And dinner was very special. But now we actually have special food we want to share pretty much every minute of the day. You might want to, share your coffee foam, which is a meme, you know?
Right. Like, it's a whole world of art out there, unexplored, or increasingly explored, let's say, right?
That's right. But that world didn't exist, you know, before, because we hadn't developed our coffee obsession. You know, something that's happened over time is the development of all these singular obsessions. Mm-hmm. You know, the obsession with the best pizza. What is the best coffee? What's the best fried chicken? And we're really competitive with each other, you know, as a nation. I don't mean you and I, because we're never competitive with each other. But, you know, like, what's the best pizza? I want you to tell me.
Right. And not only do I want you to tell, what I love about those sorts of competitions is you want to go to the ones you don't think are the best just to prove yourself. So it's good for business because, you know, everyone, it's like, nah, that's not good. You know?
Exactly. Because I think people have become extremely confident in their own opinions. And that's another reason they want to share. This is something they really know.
Right.
And they feel really strongly about it. And so I think, you know, food has invited these really passionate opinions. And, you know, that changes our everyday.
How lucky are we to be doing what we're doing now? Let me remind people listening that if you have questions for Dana about the food culture we're talking about, the magazine or the Best New Chefs or any of the things we're going to be talking about, you can dial us at 718-497-2128. You can also email us, especially if you're listening to this as an archive or an iTunes podcast, at info@heritageradionetwork.org or tweet us at TasteMattersHRN, and we'll be sure to get your questions on the air or to Dana if not on the air. So one of the things I think that's been great also about this time between the issues, let's say, is it's opened up our eyes a little bit to the imperfection sometimes of food, or the, you know, I just saw a great BuzzFeed, or maybe it was Reddit, I don't even know what that's one of the problems, you never know where you're reading, where it comes from anymore, but it was all these horrible pictures of food, the worst pictures that people posted about things that they ate, and you're working on a book that I think is great because it's about mistakes, and mastering my mistakes in the kitchen is what it's called, and I'd love to hear a little bit about that. You're working on it right now, literally, so we're grateful for your time. Tell us about that project and what kind of mistakes could Dana Cowan, the editor of Food and Wine, make?
People think that as the editor of Food and Wine, you know, maybe I have a hand in things in the kitchen, and I just don't. So I have a really talented group of people who, you know, cook for a living, and I edit for a living. And for years, I have been plagued by an inability to make a dish right the first time. Mm. And I'm equally plagued by the desire to always cook something new. So some people don't make mistakes because eventually they fix themselves.
Right.
But for me, I make it once. I roll my eyes and I just think, how could I have done that? Like it, and it happens all the time. I just literally last night, I had this beautiful fresh mozzarella. And I was like, oh, I can just see it, you know, melting in a sandwich and it would be so good. And I have this cast iron pan that I often make, you know, melted cheese sandwiches in. And I, you know, add a tortilla and I put that cheese in there and I, you know, put it in a hot pan. I was doing the right thing.
Sounds good.
Yeah. And then I turned around and I was, you know, doing something else, came back, and I looked in the pan, and it was just white, milky liquid and wet on the bottom. You should never grill mozzarella. It has too much. Okay. Milk content. You need to
old mozzarella, not fresh, maybe, or something.
You can. Right. Well, someone said, I told them yesterday, they're like, Dana, polio.
Right.
That's one word. It is right. Polio. You cannot.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah. So, do you come to work the next day and seek advice from your team about what you did wrong the night before?
I do. Uh-huh. So, Tina Yulaki, our executive food editor, has listened to my errors for so long. We actually did a one-year column together that was called Ask Irma, because I was too embarrassed back then to even admit that I made all these mistakes. And so Tina was my Irma, which is a reference to Irma Bombeck. And I would make these dumb mistakes, and Tina would correct them, and we had it as a column in the magazine. But I was, you know, too embarrassed. Now I'm not embarrassed anymore.
Good. That's great. It seems like great progress, actually. You're going to, not only you're not embarrassed, you're going to put yourself out there in a book. I have a feeling you're going to be answering a lot of questions on radio shows about mistakes people have made when that comes out.
I'm really looking forward to hearing mistakes that other people make, because sometimes my mistakes are, you know, they're so glaring, but I want to be sure that I'm not the only one. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was making a Yucatan chicken, and I was in Whole Foods, which seemed like a place that would supply me with all of the potential chilies that I needed. Mm-hmm. However, this recipe called for 3 chilies. And I don't know a whole lot about chilies. And I don't really know a whole lot about fresh ones. And I don't know a whole lot about dried ones. But they had chipotle, but they didn't have ancho, and they didn't have guajillo, dried chilies. They had dried ancho chili powder, and they had dried chipotle chili powder, but they didn't have any of the other chilies I needed. They had jalapenos, but they didn't have habaneros. And then they didn't have the whole spices I need. They only had the ground spices I need. And I went home and started making this recipe and realized I needed so much help. Right. And I went to Twitter, and, you know, I got some help, but there was a lot to learn in that one recipe.
I don't think you're alone in standing in that Whole Foods, looking at all of those things, trying to find the ingredients you need. And we're going to think about that for a moment. We'll take a brief break. We're talking with Dana Cowan, editor-in-chief of Food & Wine, and author of the soon-to-be-released, well, maybe not so soon, but currently in progress, Mastering My Mistakes in the Kitchen. This is Taste Matters.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
You are listening to Iggy Dean, Let Me In, here on Heritage Radio Network. Stay tuned for more.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with Dana Cowan, the editor-in-chief of Food & Wine magazine and the author of the forthcoming Mastering My Mistakes in the Kitchen. And we're talking about all kinds of things. We left talking about mistakes and being faced with the wrong selection of chilies to make a dish that you have a recipe for. And I'm wondering, from your editor's perspective, not from your I'm cooking dinner perspective, how do you deal with that? How are recipes, what do you expect people to do with the recipes that you guys publish? And do you think about whether or not you can just throw anything together sometimes, or what's the philosophy there?
I mean, we start with the philosophy that we want the recipes to be accessible but interesting. Mm-hmm. And the tricky part is, how interesting can interesting be before it becomes inaccessible?
Right.
So this...
If anyone has any answers to that, they can just write them in. Okay, right. We'll have an infographic on Reddit or something, but yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, when I look at a recipe that has four kinds of chilies and five kinds of spices, I think, you know what, that list is really intimidating to somebody. So we try to actually have a balance in the magazine. We have a column called Gastronaut where we do recipes that are more complicated. Mm. They might take 2 days, they might take 3 months. And I love having that kind of in-depth recipe where it's not fast and easy. You know, one of the great changes, we were talking about changes mm-hmm. over time. One of the great changes from 20 years ago to today is 20 years ago, all you could really convince anyone to do was something fast and easy. Mm-hmm. And I think today there are so many people who are so passionate and so interested. You have to give them something that has some meat and some mm-hmm. something they haven't seen before if you're at Food & Wine. And on the other hand, you have to do something that someone's going to be able to cook for dinner that night. So we try to have that whole stretch. And at the magazine, we often go to chefs for recipes mm-hmm. because chefs are innovating and creating and thinking about something new for their menus, for their dishes all the time. And we try to capture that little small piece of genius that we can help make accessible to the home cook with ingredients that you can find in a supermarket. Now, Tina Ulocki, the executive editor, and I often have conversations about what you can find. Mm. Because what is available at my supermarket is, you know, not necessarily available in Ohio. On the other hand, Tina's supermarket, which is, you know, on 14th Street and like 3rd Avenue, they have a miraculous selection. Every time I say, oh, so Tina, funny. They do not have, you know, whatever.
Guajillo, chili. Spring.
Exactly.
Right.
They don't have, you know, miso in the market. The supermarket. And she's like, yes, they do, because they do in my supermarket. So we had a lot of discussions about what's available.
Right. Well, part of the change we were talking about earlier of the enthusiasm is also that, you sort of think of, I think we sometimes think of an evolution in food culture. People are interested in trying different things, let's say, or sushi or whatever. But actually, a lot of things have to move to make a new passion possible. Let's say the supermarkets in the middle of the country need to have access to better fish or to peppers or to things in order for people to participate in something. And it's a societal change, not just a taste change.
It is, and I think that one thing that does affect the change in our tastes, which I've seen in, there's a couple of evolutions. One is the evolution towards many, many, many more vegetables. Our August issue is devoted to the vegetable because mm-hmm. Chefs are finding vegetables really intriguing to work with. So that inspires them to do great dishes in the restaurants, which therefore inspires people at home to play around a little bit more. And there are chefs who say that vegetables actually are more interesting to play with than meat, and there are more possibilities for them. So I think we see an enormous shift in taste that way. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily health-oriented, but something that we have seen a huge shift in, and we respond to at the magazine, is the change in people's taste surrounding healthy food. Mm. Some of it's driven by intolerances or allergies. So if you went to a supermarket 5 years ago, you wouldn't have found the aisles of the alternate nut milks, the alternate grains, the alternate sugars. And those ingredients that are actually answering a problem have created a whole new cuisine that I think is important to take note of and then create recipes for. So, for example, the other day, I tried to fail at it, and I didn't. I made a chia pudding with almond milk and then some chopped cherries. And we didn't have chia seeds before. I mean, we didn't have quinoa before, which is a whole other story.
Right.
But you know, that almond milk is part of this aisle of non-dairy.
Right, which gives you a whole new world of ingredients to choose from.
It does, and it's two flavors at once.
Wow. So, I still don't totally know what chia pudding is, although I know I've seen it written about a lot.
Oh, it's so good.
Okay.
It's actually like, if you imagined a tapioca pearl crossed with kiwi seeds, because it's like a little crunchy bit in the middle, but it's chewy like a tapioca. And so it just turns out to be this like gooey sort of you know, childhood looking stretchy pudding thing. That act, you know, if you make it with almond milk, and is quite delicious. Right. It has an earthy undertone.
You're reminding me. I'm just back from Japan, where one of the striking things about their appreciation of food is their appreciation of texture.
Yeah.
It's so much a part of what they enjoy, sometimes at the expense of flavor, in fact. And, you know, they'll throw little bits of cartilage into a meatball so that there's a crunch and a chew and all that kind of stuff. And I keep waiting for that to be... we love crispy. Our Americans are known around the world for being crispy fanatics, even
right.
for a long time. And I keep waiting for some other things. The way you just described that, the chewy, the texture of the chia pudding, I think is a start to begin to appreciate things like that.
Well, I had I was, you know, cooking for some people this past weekend, and the child looked at everything that I'd made, and you know, he didn't shake his head, but he sort of was like, eh. And then.
As children will do.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
And then his mother looked at me and she said, you know, he likes things that are crunchy. I'm like, okay.
So,
I ended up tossing, you know, smoked pepitas onto something. And it, like all of a sudden he would eat it because it had something crunchy in it. Like he had this awareness of it. And at the magazine, we've been developing this series of crunchy toppings. Like I'm sure you've had that. Chicken skin that is oven baked till crispy.
Sure.
And you just break that into little shards and it becomes like that crispy thing, like a crispy pancetta that, you know, tossed in a farro salad. You know, you've got this like little crunch that goes with it. And so I feel like there is an evolution in American taste towards understanding that you want like that little crunch. I mean, obviously it started with the big crouton and then went to the mini croutons.
Right.
And then it has graduated from the mini crouton into all these other possibilities for crunch.
Well, you make me wonder, you know, you often hear, I don't know what they're even called, anthropologists talk about the only taste we are born sort of with a predilection for is sweet, and babies react to sweet things. But I wonder if crunch is something that babies react to, because why would kids even know? I mean, aside from watching cereal commercials, which may be why they know, I don't know.
I don't
crunch
know.
Is good.
Because
yeah.
indeed I have a child, you know, children are often described as white food children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're really boring eaters. And I have a 10-year-old son who is not a white food eater, but he is a soft food eater. You know, not really nursery food, because he loves fiery flavors, but he doesn't like chewing very much.
Okay, too much work. More power to him.
Exactly.
Okay. So people can follow you. One of the things I love about your unofficial title is of Talent Scout, or maybe that's an official title. And your Twitter feed is FW Scout,
Correct.
Food and Wine Scout.
Yes.
And I just, in the last couple of minutes we have, any places you've been lately that you've been impressed that may make it one day to a list or something, or where you're eating around? You used to write that in your editor's letter all the time, things that were exciting you.
It's true. And in the September issue, I do a full page
of
all the places that I've been recently. And, oh my gosh, I was in New Orleans and I ate at Donald Link's most recent restaurant, which is called Pêche, like the French for fish.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we talk all the time about whole animals, and actually I want to know when the whole animal trend is going to end. But whole fish at this restaurant, Donald Link serves these extraordinary whole fish with great sauces on top. And you'd think people are a little bit scared of whole fish. They have to debone them. But I sat at a table near the kitchen, and I just watched waiter after waiter come out with a platter of whole fish.
Wow.
And it was a delicious, delicious meal. You Show in Chicago had a fabulous meal. That was the origin of that crispy skin with some Japanese seasonings on top. It was really, I love that. Bestia in Los Angeles. I've gotten actually to eat around the country quite a bit recently.
Nice.
And it's been great. And today in Bushwick, I found this place called Ange Noir. And
okay.
I just love the vibe. I can't go on a snobby routine about how, you know, fantastic the food was, though I had a fresh pressed orange juice with carrot, and I had this toast with goat cheese, walnut, and honey. But the vibe was so great, and mismatched chairs and tables, and the best owner ever. And I think one of the things that we don't always focus on in our obsessive food world is how the place feels. Mm-hmm. So the food tasted great, but this place, Ange Noir, felt fantastic, with a really caring guy behind the bar.
And it was in Bushwick, years ago people just would have laughed you off the radio for saying, for anticipating. Thank you. Oh, we have a question.
Yes, we have a question that came in over email.
Okay, let's take it.
Yes, so Dana, when something fails, what do you do with it? Throw it away or eat it anyway? I never seem to be able to get over the guilt of throwing it away, no matter how bad it turned out. Thoughts?
Yes, I try very hard not to throw things out, either, for so many different reasons. I try to rescue things that I've ruined. I'll give you two quick examples. I was trying to make a cauliflower soup. I had not roasted my cauliflower long enough, I discovered later. And I put it in the food processor and to puree it, and it would not puree, and it turned into these like itty-bitty chunks. And my daughter looked at it, and she's like, well, obviously you should make a dip. And so I scooped it out, and I made this, you know, cauliflower garlic dip, and it was delicious. So I, you know, I try not to throw things out ever. I have your guilt. And I made a pork shoulder, and it just wouldn't give up. It wouldn't give up. I roasted it forever, and it was still like as tough, and, you know, it just, you couldn't really get a fork or knife in it. I stuck it in a pot. I poured a whole bunch of liquid on it. I put a top on it, and I like let it go for more. So this was like the 7-hour pork shoulder, and it was edible at the end. I had to serve it. I mean, that was the other thing.
Okay, and for other mistakes, you're going to have to wait for the book. Right. When is it out from Echo?
It'll be out from Echo Press fall 2014.
Okay, so that's a long time. In the meantime, try to figure out what to do with your own mistakes so you have something to chat online or email with Dana about. Thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
I'm always happy to see you, Mitchell.
And thank you all for listening. Next week, we are going to actually hear a show that I recorded in San Francisco with Josh Skeens, a great chef at Saison. And we were in his beautiful restaurant chatting with him, looking through the beautiful aging rooms and all that great stuff. And so that will be next week at 11 o'clock on Wednesday. In the meantime, if you're listening to iTunes, you can download our podcast for this or any of our shows. And also at heritageradionetwork.org, you can see the complete archive. I think we're up to 90 or something right now. Hard to imagine. 95, 85, 92. I'm getting hand signals. Anyway, we are over time. Thank you for listening. Between now and next week, if you make something that doesn't work, take Dana's advice and think of something you can do with it. Don't throw it away. Don't be intimidated and don't give up. Don't think you're a bad person just because something didn't work well in the kitchen. It happens to all of us. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.